From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. Today on Newsmakers, we're looking at the role of human rights in the work of law enforcement officers. We'll hear from the father-son team behind a University of Wisconsin La Crosse class called Human Rights Policing. And what happens when police put on a greater emphasis on human rights? What's new about that concept? Haven't they been doing that all along? Later on in the show, we'll talk to some local law enforcement officers who've actually taken this course. What did they learn? How could it affect them? And how could it help them protect and serve in our listening area? Joining us right now for the first half of the discussion are Peter and Pedro Marina. Dr. Peter Marina is Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminal Justice at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. He's the creator and co-instructor of the Human Rights Policing course that I was just talking about. Peter, welcome to Newsmakers.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Also joining us, Lieutenant Pedro Marina, retired from the New Orleans Police Department after a 30-year career in law enforcement, and he is the co-instructor of UWL's Human Rights Policing course. Lieutenant Marina, thank you very much for being here.
Pleasure being here.
And so my first question is for those who are not familiar, Peter, what is human rights policing?
First, we became very interested in, looking at the role of law enforcement today in the United States. And we know that, society is going through, rapid changes. And so we became very interested in how can we reimagine what the role of law enforcement can be today. And we were thinking that one element that it always seems to have been missing is the aspect of human rights. And really, when you begin to think about it, when you look around the world and you look at our political and our economic policies, human rights is an idea, a concept, and a relatively new concept in human civilization. But it's never really actually been applied in our political and economic policies. And so, the first real articulation of human rights came in 1948 with the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. And there again, there's the expression of human rights, but one that has yet to really be applied in any aspect of our social world. So what I wanted to do is figure out how can we actually apply human rights to something like law enforcement and policing.
We have heard the concept of people's individual rights before. Obviously, in our own Constitution, we have the Bill of Rights, so on, things like freedom of speech and of religion and rights not to be inappropriately searched and those kinds of things that would apply to policing. But what are examples of some things, when you say human rights, like what kinds of things are you talking about?
Again, we're looking at the 30 articles in the Declaration of Human Rights. And so, and there's one thing that I like to make clear, I think, to everyone, including to police officers who take the class, that human rights goes beyond civil rights, and it goes beyond even our constitutional rights. So it's almost going beyond the call of duty. And so, if you look at the 30 articles of the Declaration of Human Rights, certainly there's the obvious ones, the right to dignity, the right to respect, the right to freedom of movement. Those become a very, the right of security, the right to peaceably assemble, things of that nature. And one of the contradictions I think that's rather obvious is that in general, and this is not any critique of law enforcement, perhaps there are good critiques of law enforcement, but what I'm offering right now isn't. The role of police officers in society is to prevent people from enjoying their human rights. That's exactly what they do. So there's almost a fundamental contradiction between applying human rights and serving one's duty as a police officer, which necessarily entails preventing certain people, perhaps for good reason, perhaps not, from enjoying all the human rights that belong to them. So for example, when a police officer suspects someone of some type of illegal behavior, they might stop that person to question them. Right there is preventing them from enjoying their human rights of freedom of movement. So we're very specific with what human rights we're talking about. So there's that United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, and there's also the spirit of human rights. And so one of the things that we ask police officers to do is every time they interact with members of the community, how can they allow people to enjoy as legally possible and to perform one's duty as many of the human rights that belong to them? And also, what rights must you temporarily prevent them from enjoying in order to protect the community member and the rest of the community?
That's Dr. Peter Marina of UWL, and with us also is Lieutenant Pedro Marina, retired from the New Orleans Police Department. Lieutenant Marina, I'm wondering, you first became an officer in the 1970s. What kinds of conversations were you having during those early days of your career? How different is this concept that your son has just described from what you were taught or what might have been the common practice at the time?
One of the things that shocked me as a rookie is that once a police officer gets into that air-conditioned car, he has little contact with the community. If he goes on a family disturbance, he goes in, does his thing, and now he goes back into the air-conditioned car. There's no exchange with the community. He doesn't get to know the community. The community doesn't get to know him. That's one of the first things that I thought, you know, there's something wrong with this, because we're supposed to serve this community, and yet we don't know it. We're kind of like mercenaries into the community, and it's got to change. One of the things that allowed to see different perspectives was when I was assigned to the narcotics unit. And as you know, a narcotics officer is as good as his informants. He has to cultivate informants in order to be able to do his job. And in doing so, you get to know those informants well. Sometimes you may get to know their families. And then the thing that shocked me was that I was beginning to see the world through their eyes, because I had contact with them and I saw them as human beings rather than scumbags. So that's kind of what led me to this idea, being able to go to the community and be part of that community and enforce their rights rather than deprive them of their right. Of course, with the exception, as Peter just said, sometimes we have to do that.
Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, just one thing that I'll add to that. One of the things, my father and I, we've always been, very close. And I remember a story that he told me that, coming from, Cuba, then being a police officer in a foreign country, he almost felt like, as he said, a mercenary. And when we were designing this class, we realized that, one of the most important things is for police officers to actually learn the stories of people in their community and to also tell their own stories as well. And that becomes a very important part of the class. And certainly when my father was a police officer, he also has a bachelor's degree in sociology, and he would start talking to people in the community. And as he said, see the world through the eyes of the actor, through the eyes of community members. And so that is a major part of the course, where police officers have to go to community members and community organizations, more specifically, community organizations that are very skeptical of the police. It could be Black Lives Matter organizations or other types of organizations that have historically have a negative perception of police. And so when police officers tell their own personal stories of growing up and how they became a police officer and how they think of the world, and community members share their views of the world as well, they realize that, we're all brothers and sisters that encounter the same problems, that have the same fears and joys, and we all, fall in love, and we all get our heart broken, and we all have hopes for the future. And, once you realize that we're brothers and sisters that experience so much the same in life, then I think police officers really begin to understand this idea of human rights.
Pedro, you just heard Peter talk about sharing the story, and he mentioned your own background coming from Cuba and experiencing all the different things that you have. Did you find that your background helped you kind of disarm some of the skepticism that minority communities in our country often experience regarding police?
Yes, to some degree, I did. As I joined the police department, back in those days, there were very few Hispanics. There were very few Blacks. And any Black officers had no rank. The rank structure was strictly white. So I was able to see that immediately. And so some of the things that shocked me about the police department as I came, of course, I was kind of the victim of that. You know, the police department had all kinds of lawsuits because of discrimination in the way they administered the tests. So it took me nearly 15 years to make rank because all of that was in litigation. And finally, all was settled, the exam was given, and I was promoting the first wave of promotions.
I'm wondering, Peter, you grew up in a law enforcement family, and yet some of the things that you're saying, I mean, we live in a time where police are really under a lot of attention, you know, for many good reasons. People are really paying attention to how our communities interact with law enforcement and how law enforcement interacts in our communities. Nevertheless, when people hear about a class like this being offered, that they could be forgiven for assuming that it might be highly critical of the police or something like that. Growing up in that law enforcement family, how do you approach this class? Is it fair to think of it as being critical?
No, and I think that's one of the new approaches. One of the, you know, I did a pilot study for the course, and prior to offering that pilot study, we asked police officers, you know, what were their greatest concerns? And one of the things that they were concerned about is, you know, being beaten over the head with the idea of, you know, white privilege. And so I didn't really want to attack it from that angle. And personally, me, I like to reach out to my brothers and sisters on both sides of the aisle. I like to reach out to my conservative brothers and sisters and my liberal brothers and sisters. And so to me, it really doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum one comes on. In fact, I don't really, you know, care or know what's inside of anybody's heart or a police officer's heart. I really don't care. They can be a radical far right winger, or they could be radical leftist, Marxist, you know, communist, whatever they are. That's perfect. You know, whatever. The most important thing is that we actually apply human rights to our interactions with community members. And so long people are on board with that, that's the only thing that I'm really concerned about. And that's one of the things that I think police officers began to really understand in the class, that it's not a cop bashing class. It's critical. And I can talk to you a little bit about how we approach matters such as like race and class and gender and ethnicity, but it's from a very different perspective that they probably have never received before.
One of the things that is presented on UWL's website in kind of the outline for the course is this concept of agency and this concept of the control that each individual person can exercise over their own decisions and their own practices. At least that's my understanding of it. Talk about this concept of agency and how it applies in this area of human rights policing.
The idea of agency to me is the most romantic and beautiful word in the English language. It's the thing that allows us to go against our biological and cultural determinisms. It allows us to violate the taken for granted scripts and social roles that have been given to us, that we just play kind of like this as we, you know, we go about our social life, almost like a sleepwalking through our waking life. It allows us to push back against those great structural forces shaping and determining our behavior. And so this idea of agency, I think when police officers realize that they can go against their own biological and cultural determinisms, when they can go against even the culture of the police department, when they can go against the rules and scripts and societal expectations and do something else, they realize that they can become extraordinary. Their world opens up and they realize that their actions matter and that they can actually make change. It's a very powerful concept. It gives any human being a sense of power and control over who they are and what they want to become. And once police officers know that, I think the world opens up to them. They realize that human rights policing becomes a real possibility, not just some virtue signaling word.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Marina and Lieutenant Pedro Marina about their course, Human Rights Policing, today on Newsmakers. Coming up, we'll talk about some examples of policing from this perspective, find out a little bit more about how that works and how you could sign up for the course if you're a law enforcement officer interested in learning more. We always want to hear from you, of course, as well. If you want to weigh in on this or any other subject, I'd love to hear from you. You can email us, newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall from our studios on the campus of UW-La Crosse. We're talking about human rights policing today on Newsmakers. Peter Marina and Pedro Marina are my guests. Peter is a sociology and criminal justice professor at UW-La Crosse. Pedro is a retired New Orleans police officer. I'm very glad to have them on the show today. So let's give some examples about how this human rights policing philosophy can be applied. Lieutenant Marina, can you think of an example or a situation that an officer might encounter and how they might approach it both with and without a human rights policing perspective?
I'll give you an example. I suppose that a police officer on patrol, he drives through a particular neighborhood and he sees some people that hanging in a corner that maybe they're selling dope, maybe they're not. I think if you have that human rights perspective, you are going to hold yourself back before you take any action. And if you do go to speak to those individuals about any possible criminal behavior, you are going to look at the world from their eyes. I think that's important to see how do they perceive you? Because at the end of the day, the community has to buy into the police department. And if police officers just at random just stop people and regardless of their humanity, so to speak, and talk to them in any kind of way, that's not going to work. And I think that's one of the ways that human rights policing will work in that regard.
It's a common refrain that that people will bring up about the danger involved in police work, and you know firsthand about how dangerous police work can be, and even though most of the time, hopefully that doesn't happen. Most of the time, hopefully everybody walks away from the situations that come up safely. It is a possibility, and so. You know, as police approach their work, how can they adopt this human rights mindset in policing while still maintaining vigilance against something that at any moment could be a dangerous and life-threatening scenario?
Oh, is that for me?
Either I'd be interested in either one of your perspectives.
I don't see a contradiction. In fact, I think that the application of human rights policing makes things safer for both the community and the police officers. I think one of the problems is that there's a serious, there's probably misconceptions on both sides of community members and police officers, and certainly a lot of mistrust between both groups. And I think once police officers begin to change their perception, again, whether that perception is real or it's perceived, once they begin to change that perception and establish rapport and build trust with the people in the community, and the community believes that police officers are now on their side, they're there to protect their human rights, that they're there to make people safer, that they're there to, you know, watch their back, I believe that that'll actually make things safer for both community members and police officers. We're certainly not advocating for police officers to let down their guard. I mean, I'm from the city of New Orleans. I walk around and I don't let down my guard when I walk around. And so, you know, police officers need to also maintain, their own level of vigilance and care, and you know, make sure that they protect themselves and the people around them. And so I actually view that as working beautifully together, this idea of human rights, building trust, building rapport, which I think also leads to more safety between the community and police officers. I did want to also give another little example of an application of human rights that I thought was fitting. And it was just a story that popped into my head that a police officer recently gave me. And it was, he pulled someone over and maybe the person had a broken brake light or something like that. But they noticed that there was a child in the car and there was no car seat. Certainly, a person could get in some degree of trouble, at the very minimum, a ticket for not having a car seat. But he realized, I would give this person a ticket. They wouldn't be, you know, they would have a hard time paying it. They couldn't even afford the car seat. So how are they going to get the, you know, pay the ticket and then get the car seat? And so he said, you know, instead of giving anyone a ticket or you know, making anyone, you know, giving anybody trouble, why not? I have an extra car seat. I'm going to go ahead and take a car seat out of my personal car. I'm going to give it to this person, you know, and ask him if there's anything else I can do. And you know, now the baby is safe. No one got a ticket. The community is better off. And this is human rights. And so it doesn't have to be these big city, you know, cop, you know, people hanging on the corner slinging dope stories. Sometimes it's just some of the small things that you find in smaller towns and you know, more rural types of communities. And, you know, I'd never really known anything about rural communities until I went to Wisconsin, right? But that's where, you know, my I've done a lot of ride-alongs with police officers here in Wisconsin. So I learned really a lot about how smaller cities and smaller law enforcement agencies work at a very local level. My father comes from, you know, very big city as well. And so we're able to bring both of those experiences and talk about how we can apply human rights in radically different ways.
That's
let me add a small one, a little short police story here. I was in the 8th District, which is the downtown area and French Quarter of the city. And I got called to a restaurant. There was a man, homeless, my apparently who had fallen asleep. Well, I responded to the call, I arrived, and I said, man, well, I didn't personally know him, but I had dealt with him before. I knew he wasn't altogether well in the head. And in fact, he had asked me one time when he was down and out to put him in jail so he could get a meal. So I knew him from then. Anyway, I asked him, said, man, look, you can't go, you can't sleep here, you need to leave, okay? So. Well, he gets up and he goes by the door. And when I'm ready to also go out by the door, he takes a knife and starts going at me with a knife. And I start backing away. I take my Glock 45 and Glock 40 and point it at him. I said, man, don't let me do this. And he starts backing, coming towards me. I'm on the sidewalk in front of the restaurant. And if I was a civilian, I would just run. But I'm a police officer. I can't just run. And I don't want to kill this man. He's crazy. So he's coming at me with a knife and coming at me with a knife and backing away. I said, please don't let me do this. Well, to my surprise, a garbage truck pulled right behind me. And I knew the garbage collectors because I dealt with them all the time in the district. And they snuck behind the man and grabbed him and took the knife away from him. And I bring that example to illustrate how interaction with the community, how getting to know the community, and how the community respects police, how that can make it safe for police officers, how that can change the dynamics of police interactions.
We've seen all the examples, you've alluded to a couple of them today, Peter, of people who have been injured, even killed during conversations with police. It's become a major theme in our local conversations, all the way into our national and international politics, and even more. How do the principles of human rights policing apply to some of those issues that we've seen even here in Wisconsin?
You know, in our society, we do, you know, we manufacture through things like moral panics, folk devils, which are people, oftentimes institutionally vulnerable or marginalized people, that are oftentimes scapegoated and blamed for larger social problems like crime or poverty or something else. We see them in terms like super predator or thug, or you know, we see that with the various immigrant groups who have come to the United States, from the Irish that were Celtic ape-like creatures to current Latin Americans today, who have gotten certainly negative stereotypes. We see, you know, not only our own internal domestic folk devils, people turned into social pariahs, but we see it internationally as well, which justifies awful wars that have been raging for, you know, decades and decades and decades. And so we talk to police officers about how exactly this happens. How do moral panics arise? And how are specific groups of people who are generally, again, institutionally marginalized and vulnerable, become these social pariah group, become these folk devils? And then I talk about, you know, how this is manufactured, how this is created, and how they're blamed for larger structural problems. And then we talk about, well, how can we defolk devil people? How can we reverse this process of what's happened? And that's why what I alluded to earlier, we have police officers actually talking with people, getting their stories, in turn telling their stories as well. And I think that's a problem in general with not only the news media, but even sociologists who oftentimes they write about poor people. Sometimes they make them into heroes. Sometimes they folk devil them. But either way, it's exploitative because it's somebody else, usually more powerful, telling the stories of other people. And so when police officers learn the stories of gang members, and I have my brothers in the Latin Kings and Queens that have taught with me at a university before, certainly not in Wisconsin, but in places like New York. Once you learn more about, you know, gang members or people that are, living in, the inner city, or you talk to people that have taken that awful journey from coyotes into the United States, and you hear their story, again, you realize, that these stereotypes, these stigmas as social pariah people are simply false. They've been fabricated. We've been sold a bag of goods. These people, their heart beats the same way as we do. They have the same love and compassion and concerns. They want to spread their wings as well and be alive and live and prosper and be safe and have peace and have families. And they want to live their lives just like we do. And so, and they really begin to experience, police officers really begin to experience that as they connect with people and bond with people. I think the opposite of making people social pariahs is bonding, connecting. And once police officers do that in a very real and a very genuine way with people in their community, all of the prejudices, the biases that have been given to us since birth, they begin to melt away. They're gone. The second part is, and I alluded to a little bit before, police officers don't like to be beaten over the head with, white privilege this, white privilege that. And I'm not saying that there isn't white privilege. Obviously, there's institutional racism and white privilege. But I think that's a very poor method of teaching people, especially people that have been blamed for a lot of social problems, like police officers. Police can't solve the problem of crime, yet when crime rates go up, they're the first ones thrown under the bus. So I thought about it. How can I approach race, gender, sexuality to police officers who are naturally and understandably defensive about such things? And I thought about the ideas of a famous sociologist marginalized in the United States. It was a Black intellectual, W.E.B. Du Bois, who wrote this idea called the double consciousness. And he talked about this feeling of two-ness that he had as a Black intellectual, a Black man in America, but also being an American, and that these were two very conflicting identities that could never, merge together. And he always felt this feeling of two-ness and this double consciousness. Then I thought about it, and my father and I have talked about it, and he said, well, as Cuban Americans, we felt like that as well. We've been othered. We've been made into an inferior. We've been made outsiders. And then I thought about it. Oh my God. I do this to people all the time without even thinking about it. And here I am, well-schooled. I think of myself, at least I fancy myself, as progressive. And yet I still do the same thing subconsciously that other people have done to W.B. Du Bois and that have done to my father and I. And I realize, well, that's because we're humans. We're all biased. We're all prejudices. We all have our own colors and views that have shaped our reality and our perception of others. And so I asked police officers to think about how they have been othered for anything. It could be because of their weight. They're too big or they're too small. Their skin color, they're too white or they're too dark. Their gender, their ethnicity. We've all been othered in some way. We've all been made the inferior. We've all been excluded in some way. So it's a human thing. And so the point isn't to make up lies and say that we're anti-racist or that we can be race neutral or colorblind. These are fictions. We're human beings, flawed with prejudices and biases. The point is to examine them, to understand them, to make sense of them, to scrutinize them. And so I asked police officers, now how? You've probably been othered. How have you done that to others in ways that you never even thought about? Have you made the other the inferior, the outsider, right? The one who doesn't belong? And once they understand that their professor does it, and that my father does it, and that you've done it, and that we've all done it, they begin to put their defenses down because it's a very human thing that that we do to all people. And then they begin to examine it. And part of the class, they actually have to tell stories how they've done that to others and how it's been done to them. They begin to understand how human beings do that. And once we can understand, once we have consciousness about what we do, that can shape our actions.
It's really interesting, and I'm afraid I'm running out of time here, but I want to give you an opportunity to mention where people who might be listening assuming they either are or know people who are in law enforcement, because that's who this class is mostly directed at. But if someone's interested in finding out more about the class and when it's offered, where can they find that information?
You can simply, I don't want to say Google because I don't like Google, DuckDuckGo or something, some other private website. You can look up UWL La Crosse, Human Rights Policing. We'll pop right on up. It goes with the UWL's Graduate and Extended Learning Program. And so if they look up, again, UWL Human Rights Policing or Pedro Marina or Peter Marina Human Rights Policing, boom, it'll pop up. And then there's a whole easy kind of instructions. Or you can simply reach out to me, P. Marina at uwlax.edu. And I'm more than happy to talk with anyone about human rights policing. And I can also give the contact information to my father as well, with 30 years experience in the New Orleans Police Department.
That sounds really great. Dr. Peter Marina is a professor at UWL and is the creator and co-instructor of Human Rights Policing. Peter, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Lieutenant Pedro Marina is retired after 30 years on the New Orleans Police Department and is also the co-instructor of Human Rights Policing. Pedro, thanks a lot for your expertise and point of view today.
Thank you for having us.
This is Newsmakers. Coming up, we hear from local law enforcement officers who have participated in the course that we've been talking about. We'll hear what they thought of it, how it's affected their approach to protecting and serving here in our listening area. Remember, you can hear this conversation again or stream any of our previous episodes on demand. Just go to WPR.org/newsmakers. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. We're back in a minute. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest studio. We are talking about human rights policing today on WPR. It's an approach to law enforcement that encourages officers to see situations through the experiences of the people that they encounter in the course of their work. And there's more to it than that. I'm oversimplifying, as you know, if you've heard our previous conversation with teachers Peter Marina and Pedro Marina. As we heard from them earlier, the course uses the 30 articles of the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights as kind of a framework. And joining us now are two officers who've been through the human rights policing course. We've got Sergeant Mike Valencia of the La Crosse County Sheriff's Department. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us on Newsmakers.
Thank you for having me.
We've also got Sergeant Nikki Miller from UW La Crosse University Police. Nikki, thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you.
So I'm interested, as we start off, we've heard a lot about the class, what's in it, sort of the philosophy behind it. I want to ask each of you, Nikki, let's start with you. What's one of the major lessons that you took away from the human rights policing class?
One of the major lessons that I felt that I learned is that sometimes in this course of our business, we're seeing people at a time where things are pretty troublesome for them. And it's very important that we remember that all people are people, and we have to treat people with dignity and respect. And that's part of human rights policing, just treating someone the way that you'd want to be treated. And keep in mind that if it was one of your family members, how would you want that person to be treated as well, to give the optimum experience so that maybe I can change the mindset of what policing looks like for a person that may have had a bad experience in the past.
What about you, Mike? What's a major takeaway from the human rights policing class?
We want to go away. Certainly, we can't be all things to everyone. But at the same time, treating people with dignity and respect is very important in our jobs. And there's a variety of ways that we can do that. And it's treating everyone that way, regardless of where they're from, what their background is, what their current situation is. It's every day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We are there for the people and finding ways to connect with them, as Nikki said, when they're not sometimes in the best condition or having their own struggles or whatever's going on. We have to do our utmost to try to figure out a way to connect with them before, during, and after. I can tell you in my experience in law enforcement over the past 25 years, I've met a lot of great people. And they still call me from time to time. And when I see them on the street, we have a conversation and we talk. And that's from all walks of life. It's not from one demographic solely. There are people that I see in various states, and sometimes they remember who I am and sometimes they don't. And we, you know, but we connect, and that's the important part. And if today I can help them, and tomorrow they reach out for me, or a year from now they reach out for me, which they have in the past, that's awesome. And sometimes it saves a call for service somewhere else because they made that connection, and it prevents a problem that might arise later with someone who doesn't know them.
When you heard about this class, human rights policing, Peter talked to us about some of the things that he incorporated into the class, some of the motivation behind designing it the way that he did. What did you think about it? What preconceptions did you come to the class with, Mike?
Peter had done a ride along with our agency, and he seemed to ride around with me a lot, and I had a great time. And he's a very interesting, wonderful person. He's just one of those unique individuals. He and I had some great discussions. So, and I think one of the things that, at least for this class, when it comes to human rights policing, having been in the military, they talked about human rights and things like that. And we went over them frequently, but in law enforcement, and what I told him at the time of the class was, this, when I was in recruit school, was never talked about. And it's something that should be incorporated from day one in when we train our officers and jailers. This should be, if we want to talk about something for reform for the future, this is a goal. This was important in 1948 when Universal Declaration of Human Rights came out. It was because of extreme atrocities that had been committed against human populations. It's that important. And it's been around for that long. And we don't talk about that in American law enforcement. And it's time. I thought it was, having been in law enforcement as long as I had, it was a phenomenal way to think of it and something to bring in.
Nikki, Peter and Pedro talked about using your own story to kind of contextualize work, and not only seeing your work through the lens of how somebody that you're encountering in public might view it, but also using your story to help people understand where you're coming from in your work. What do you wish people knew more about what it's like being a law enforcement officer?
Well, I wish people would understand that we're a sample of the population for the communities we serve. Law enforcement comes from our communities. So unfortunately, some people are going to come with, you know, maybe implicit bias or prejudicial ways because of the way they were raised and the way they were taught. So once we get into this profession of policing, it's our opportunity to educate ourselves, to understand what our community members look like, how we can relate to our community members, and make sure that we're educated to know that if I'm going to Among residents, for example, for a law enforcement reason, as a female officer, I have to make sure that I'm communicating with the correct person because I don't want to portray any disrespect to, per se, like an elder in the household. Also, I think that officers have to realize too, empathy is one of the biggest things that we need to teach so that we can put ourselves in the shoes of the people that we're dealing with at the time and figure out the way to communicate the best we can, even dealing in times where people are at their worst. I mean, mental health right now is a major uptick in our community. So if someone is struggling with wanting to harm themselves, the questions we need to ask is, how can I understand what this person is going through and portray to them that I'm educated enough to assist them with their needs and there's not going to be any judgment? And at that time, this is the most important thing I'm dealing with, because for them in that crisis moment, it is. And that's really important. Another thing that I'm a little disappointed is there's been a couple officers out there that have made some bad decisions that affects us all as a profession. And I don't like for those officers' decisions to be projected onto me or the guys that work here in my department, because we're trained differently and that's not how I respond. So I think it's really cool when the public gets the opportunity to do like citizen police academies, So they get to understand their police departments, get to understand the makeup of those police departments and who those officers are, kind of give that personal experience with instead of always the person in the uniform. And that's what I like to do as well and portray, because I've gone through hardships in my life. And it seems like when you show up as a law enforcement officer, that perception is there's no way you can understand what I've gone through because you're in that uniform, you've never lived this. And they forget that we're people too, with various different experiences as well, that we can bring to the table to help resolve whatever issue that they're dealing with at that time.
That's Sergeant Nikki Miller with the UW La Crosse University Police Department. Sergeant Mike Valencia is with us here as well from La Crosse County Sheriff's Department. Nikki, you just talked about when you have an officer who acts inappropriately, it can reflect on the whole community of police officers. And to that end, I want to jump ahead to another question that I've got here on this in my preparation and get you to react to it. Departments have been under the microscope in recent years for some of the reasons that you mentioned. And it can seem to outsiders that when there's criticism of those kinds of practices, when there's criticism of a department, it can appear as though officers kind of close ranks around each other, regardless of the validity of that criticism. And I'm wondering how police departments, sheriff's offices, other law enforcement entities can do better so that while still standing up for each other and supporting each other as colleagues who share all these experiences in common, how they can still be more open to aspects of that criticism that might be valid.
And that's a really good question. I think transparency is the key there. I mean, you'll see on a lot of different police departments' websites where they list their policy and procedures. They list calls for service. They list things that they're dealing with within their departments. And I think that's really important and very crucial. When I say transparency, what I mean by that is when the community asks us questions, we have to answer those difficult questions. There is that solitude, the brotherhood of, you know, the thin blue line with brothers and sisters that work the same field. But a lot of times that gets a negative connotation that we're protecting those that have done wrong. And that's not what that's meant to do. The thing is that a lot of times us officers, we understand what we're going through. And I think sometimes that conceptions out there that they don't understand that even when we have to take a life in the course of our profession or use force, that sometimes causes a lot of internal conflict for us because we're human beings too. And we don't want to have to do that to people. But sometimes we're put in a situation where it's authorized, it's legally justified, but it's difficult. So to have those hard conversations or to do like scenario-based training with our community to say, hey, I'm gonna put you in a situation that I had to deal with. And I'd like to see what your response would be to that. So that maybe understand where we're coming from. But we also have to take into account too, when we have these accountability boards for use of force or things of that nature, it's very important to have a person from the community on that because they don't have that background knowledge of law enforcement. And that allows us to see the perspective through their lens as a community member that we may not have because we're so ingrained into what we've been taught and how we act due to policy and procedure and what we know is legally justified based upon state laws and policies in our departments.
I asked Pedro about this earlier. I mean, he worked for a long time for the New Orleans Police Department, and I'm interested right. in your perspective too. If you're in a position that like the dangerous aspects of the job, hopefully you very rarely face those. Hopefully they don't make themselves known every single day. But it's always a possibility every time you go out and every time you work. How can you balance the need to take great care and to always be vigilant against potential danger and always be on the alert to be able to protect yourself, your colleagues, members of the public, and everything else, without kind of, you know, without making everybody the bad guy? You know, it seems like that intersects a lot with what this human rights policing approach is. And I'm just wondering how an approach like this might help in that regard, or does it, or what your thoughts are on that?
My thoughts on this, and under, I would have to say this from my background. I'm a trainer with my agency. I've trained people in my agency throughout the county, throughout the state of Wisconsin and the United States. I was part of our emergency response team for 21 years. So when you talk about those dangers, I didn't just face the dangers on the street. when I came to work. I was also called out in the middle of the night to deal with dangers that were very serious that our typical police officers could not handle and they needed assistance with. So a big part of that is seeing human beings as human beings, not demonizing them for what's going on, not trying to project yourself as the sole authority on what's going to happen, but to convince them that there are choices, that their abilities to do other things. Still, all the while, understand we have to be cognizant of what our responses are and how we're feeling and what our capabilities are at any given point in time. So that's a self-assessment is extremely important, a self-assessment of ourselves, of our situation, what's changed, what's not changed is ongoing and it never stops. That evaluation has to be going through our heads every moment. And sometimes just the little subtleties of way people can shift or move or things like that changes what we perceive as might be going on and happening. Training, as Nikki said, is extremely important. And I think that when she talks about those training, and she said it too, training like in the civilian academies, showing our general public some of the things that we have to consider and think about all the time really opens their eyes to what we have to face on a daily basis. But, you know, I think being resilient and staying ahead of the curve is always important, and not overreacting is key. That's, no, you know, that's just one of those things sometimes that causes a lot of problems.
Nikki, when we were getting ready for today's interview, you were sharing some of your previous experiences, and you've worked in quite a variety of contexts. You're a university police officer now. You've worked with a municipal police department. You've been a jailer before, and had other experiences in law enforcement. As you look at this concept of applying this Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the 30 precepts that it contains to the work of police officers, is there an environment where that advice is more applicable?
Absolutely. I mean, let's take a look at the jail setting. When I was a jailer, I was dealing primarily with 30 men in a pod that were there for making a bad decision that resulted in them losing their freedom, right? So the way I interacted with them and the way I spoke with them, as long as I treated them with the dignity and respect they deserve, there weren't any problems. And if there's a situation where maybe something was stressful to the point where we had to intervene and maybe follow some jail rules or something like that, having that simple dialogue with a person, explain the reason why a lot of times will calm them. And then eventually they'll become rational enough to understand, okay, this is what I did, this is the consequence. Now I have the opportunity to prove myself again later. And I teach in recruit class right now for the Western Technical College. I've been doing that since 2009 as a defensive tactics instructor. And I always tell people that our job is 95% speaking. If you know how to talk to someone, you'll get a lot of verbal compliance, voluntary compliance. So the use of force should be minimal. And if you take a look at an officer in his or her service, you'll see those officers that can talk to anyone, any walk of life. And I like to think I'm that kind of person. I've had officers tell me before that I could say things to people that others can't because it'll be perceived in a different way. You know, I have a goofy sense of humor. But I also know, too, when a situation is presented itself where dialogue's not going to work and I can't get through to the person. So like Mike was saying, I might have to utilize some type of a control tactic that may not look good to the general public. But afterwards, after I calm the person down, after they're out of that crisis cycle and explain why I did what I did, there's always that understanding in that, okay, yeah, this is why you have to do what you did, and I'm sorry to have to come to that. And I think by educating the general public, that's a means for us to be able to, for them to understand that police have to make split-second decisions, and those decisions have to be based upon our safety and the safety of the community, and also for the person that we're dealing with. So the way you speak to someone, the way you articulate your needs, the way you can give that explanation a lot of times might be enough to bring that volatile situation to something a little more calm so you can work together towards a resolution.
It's a very interesting discussion, and I wish we had time to continue further, but we don't, so we're going to set it aside for now. two participants in this human rights policing course have been with us. Sergeant Nikki Miller from the UW La Crosse University Police, whom you've just heard. Thank you very much for sharing your perspective with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And Sergeant Mike Valencia is with the La Crosse County Sheriff's Department. Sergeant Valencia, thank you very much as well.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure and hope to hear from you soon.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. You can hear our show a number of times each week. We're on Friday mornings at 10 on the Ideas Network 90.3. Our program repeats Friday night at 7 on NPR News and Music 88.9. And of course, we're always online at WPR.org/newsmakers. For Dawn Jewell, our producer, I'm Ezra Wall. Join us again next time for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.